Greetings, 12. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks, along with Nick Lee. Happy Blue Friday. The combine well underway. Today had running backs and offensive linemen participating in all the drill work. We talked about those positions the past few days. We are going to be swinging to the defensive side of the football, looking at thresholds for cornerbacks and safeties to close out the week. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. When we get to this time of year on the calendar, teams are pretty darn secretive when it comes to sharing their intentions for the offseason. They'll speak with reporters, but it's almost like it's a competition between coaches and general managers to see who can talk the most without actually saying anything meaningful. So really, Nick, it puts the term coach speak to a new level.
Yeah, this is peak coach speak time. Lots of smoke screens, lots of jockeying for position, especially with the draft and the combine and free agency looming in the next couple weeks. This is, take everything that you hear in the next few weeks about prospects, about free agents and anything like that with a huge grain, a boulder of salt, if you will.
A boulder. That's about right, salt, though. It's true.
But besides that, Corbin, those conversations can unearth meaningful information. And I know you were speaking with General Manager John Schneider off the podium in Indy, and he had some interesting things to say. And if you can get, any sort of news this time of year, or not news, but any sort of nuggets this year, you'll take it because it's so full of smoke screens. But it sounds like you uncovered a few.
Yeah, I was surprised. I wasn't surprised about what was said by John Schneider necessarily, but I still didn't expect him to be so forthcoming about it, given the time of year. We're at the combine where teams, like I said, are usually so guarded. But he was asked when we were discussing some things off podium with Schneider, he was asked about the franchise tag and the transition tag. This is a really weird year because the league right now is working with the NFL Players Association on a new CBA. According to John Clayton, that vote at the earliest is going to happen next Wednesday. So that's really a huge deal going on in the NFL right now. But there's a little bit of a quirk that's going on because of it. We're in the final year of the current CBA. And because of that, teams actually now can use both the franchise and transition tag at the same time. They can use both of them. Normally, you can only pick one or the other. Teams typically use the franchise tag. Transition tags aren't used a ton because you don't get compensation back if a team signs that player and you don't match the offer. So that's the big difference. A little less money and less protection for teams trying to avoid other teams from signing their players. But that's beside the point here. Schneider was basically asked, does this increase the chances that teams are going to use both of them? And his comment was, for some clubs, it's probably A. And then he paused for like 10 seconds. I think he was trying to figure out, how do I answer this question without giving up too much? But I was surprised what he said next. He said, we're not in that world, so I'm sure I don't see us tagging anybody. I'm sure it's going to be a huge benefit to a couple of clubs that feel they are going to have a chance to lose an impact player. But basically, he came right out and said, we are not going to be using the franchise or transition tag. And really, Nick, nobody should be surprised by that comment coming from him. Like I said, though, it was just a bit more forthcoming than I was expecting him to be. But they have only used the franchise tag twice in his 10 seasons with the team. They've never used the transition tag. So really, it's not that big of a surprise.
No, it's not. Also, it's nice to get sort of that kind of confirmation, though, in this time of year. But thinking about what the franchise tag would have meant for a couple free agents for the Seahawks, obviously the Jadeveon Clowney isn't part of that conversation with the logistics there of them receiving him via trade. But with Jermaine Ifedi and Jaron Reed, if you're thinking about lamenting the fact that the Seahawks are not putting the tag on those two players, let me enlighten you a bit with what they would have cost. Defensive tackles, the franchise tag this year is around $15.5 million. So you're talking paying Jaron Reed $15.5 million for 2020. And then for Jermaine Ifedi, it gets even better. $16.102 million for Jermaine Ifedi to return to the Seattle. And that's after turning down his fifth-year option, which would have been cheaper. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. So, no surprise whatsoever. Of course, the landscape can change quickly, but it's certainly not looking likely because, only used it twice. I believe once was on a kicker. So I wouldn't hold your breath at all here in the next week or so of tagging people.
Yeah, you mentioned with Jermaine Ifedi that the Seahawks had a chance to bring him back for a fifth season at just a little over $10 million. So we're talking about a $6 million difference in a season. There's no way the Seahawks would be paying that price tag. The only way I could have seen them doing this for either player, I mean, Reed's coming off a very disappointing season. He was suspended for six games. He had that one phenomenal 2018 season. But even with that said, coming off his recent production, you're not going to fork that kind of money into him either. The only way that I would ever see that they would have done this is if they felt they were going to be able to get a long-term deal, and that was the only way they could prolong negotiations. And I don't see that being the case with either one of these players. That's not to say that it's impossible that either one of them won't be back. I mean, there's a way that, you know, if they hit the market, I actually would be more optimistic about Reed, because I look at this market for tackles, and Jermaine Ifedi is going to be rolling in money. He's going to be like that guy in Breaking Bad that's just laying on a huge stack of money and doing snow angels. You know, he's going to be rolling in the dough because there aren't very many tackles out there. He's got age in his favor. He's in a prime. He's improved the last couple years, first round pedigree, all those things. So I think he's going to fetch around that $16 million per year, to be honest with you. I think a team is going to pay him that kind of money. Jaron Reed, I'm a lot more skeptical that he's going to be able to get to that 15 mark. I could see him being a guy, he's, you know, he said openly that $10 million is embarrassing. Well, based on the numbers that he had last year, I'd be pretty darn happy if I got $10 million from a team. And with the market being saturated at that position, maybe it gives Seattle a little better chance to be able to re-sign him. But there's no way the Seahawks are going to use a franchise tag on either one of those. Like you said, the landscape can change quickly. We saw Frank Clark last year. They franchise tagged him, and Schneider was hoping to get him extended. And then we see how things change. They ended up trading him in April. The deal didn't work out. Gave him some more cap flexibility, extra picks. Things change, but that being said, I would be stunned if the Seahawks turn around and pull a 180 and use one of those franchise or transition tags on either one of those players, and there's nobody else on their free agency list that they would be using it on. So I would say that when he said he doesn't see him tagging anybody, that he's being 100% sincere there. That is not going to happen. When we return from the break, it's Free Agency Friday. We're going to look at four free agents, two on offense, two on defense, that could be solid fits for the Seahawks. We are getting very close to free agency. So these are meaningful discussions to have this time of year. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. This is Corbin Smith along with Nick Lee. Coming up in the third quarter, as we've been doing for the past several days, we've been looking at thresholds and measurements the Seahawks consider for each position group. We're going to wrap things up with cornerbacks and safeties looking in the secondary. But first, it's Free Agency Friday, as we've been doing every week for the last month or so since the season ended for the Seahawks. We're going to take a look at four upcoming free agents that are going to be on the market, outside free agents from other teams that the Seahawks may have interest in, or at least should have interest in. And these four guys are all very intriguing. Two offensive players, two defensive, and we're getting very close to free agency. I don't think people realize, I mean, once you get through the combine, it's a blur. It's going to turn to March here in the next couple days, and teams are going to be able to sign players by March 18th. The approved tampering time starts on March 16th. So you basically have 2.5 weeks until the madness is starting with free agency, and that's going to be something for several days. It's going to be a really mad time for all of us that are in the sports media industry, and obviously teams are already gearing up for that. Lots of negotiations going on behind the scenes right now in Indianapolis. Let's get to our first free agent here, Nick. We've talked about this a few times. The Seahawks have two outstanding receivers in Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. This receiving class for the draft is loaded, so there's a lot of discussion about Seattle potentially using an early pick on a receiver, and even if they wait, there could be some really good receivers available on day three. So there's a great chance for them to add depth and talent to the receiving core in April. But at the same time, there are some free agents out there that could make some sense at the right price. And one that you and I are in agreement would make a lot of sense. And again, the price point is everything. But that's veteran slot receiver Randall Cobb.
Yeah, Randall Cobb, of course, mostly known for his days with the Packers. Played with the Packers for 8 seasons with Aaron Rodgers. And, you know, that'll make your numbers look pretty good playing with Aaron Rodgers. But he also had a very strong season with who I think is a pretty mediocre quarterback in Dak Prescott last year. He had 828 receiving yards and 55 catches last year, 3 touchdowns. and a pretty productive year. He's a Pro Bowler in 2014 with the Packers when he had almost 1,300 yards and 12 touchdowns. So he has a history of production. And he started dying off a little bit in Green Bay the last few years and then kind of had a resurgence, a resurrection for his career in 2019. So for me, he's not a DK Metcalf. He's 5'10". He is, like you said, a true slot corner. So you could do a lot of things with him and Tyler Lockett, because Tyler Lockett kind of fills that role a little bit. And of course, it will not hurt to add a guy with that kind of pedigree and that kind of experience to this roster. Because I think anytime you can add a veteran with I think DK Metcalf is at a point where if he can, of course, Tyler Lockett's a very valuable piece, but bringing in someone else who has had different NFL experiences and giving DK Metcalf that much more to mentorship it can't be a bad thing. And he might take a few targets away from receivers from Lockett and Metcalf, but I think he's still a very productive receiver. He has had some injuries in the past, and he can be prone to drops. He had 8 drops last year. Really, with those drops, Corbin, he could have had 1,000 yards in Dallas with Dak Prescott as his quarterback.
Well, and you and I disagree on Dak Prescott. I think Dak is a very good quarterback. I don't think mediocre fits, but you and I have had this discussion before. That's for another time period. But that offense was really darn good throwing the football around, and I thought Randall Cobb, for making $5 million last year, I mean, he'd had some injuries a couple of years before, and it really limited his production. So he was just trying to reprove himself, and I think he did that. The drops are certainly a concern. 8 is way too many, but DK Metcalf had 7. So Seattle had a receiver that had big numbers that still dropped some passes. And I look at that maybe as being a little bit of a fluke. There have been plenty of seasons where he's been much better in that regard, and he's still not quite 30 years old. So with that being said, I think
feels like he's been in the league for 20 years.
Yeah, it does feel like he's been around for a really long time. He came into the league very young out of Kentucky, but I think this is what excites me about him, looking at what he did last season in Dallas. 329 yards after the catch. Seattle can use help in yak anywhere they can find it. And this is a guy that can create yardage. He actually a running back with a football in his hands after the catch. I could see that being valuable in Seattle's offense, where they've been near the bottom of the league the last couple years in producing yards after the catch. And he also averaged 15 yards per reception, and that was in the top 30 in the NFL last year. So he's not a guy that's going to burn you deep often, but he's a guy that picks up chunk yardage, and a lot of that's to do with the fact he can create after the catch. So putting him in the slot, he can play some on the outside still too, gives you some versatility. It's a veteran that would be another quality receiver that you're not expecting to come in and be your number one guy. At this point in his career, he's a very good number three, though. And if you could get him for around that $6 million price point, I think it would make a lot of sense. Now, looking at the offensive line, this is a player that you actually caught on today that he was even a free agent. Somehow, this guy's name had slipped past me. I think actually some of the websites thought that he was still entering his fifth year option, but that was last season with the New Orleans Saints. And that is versatile offensive lineman Andres Pete.
Andres Pete got raving reviews from future Hall of Fame quarterback Drew Brees, saying that he was their most versatile offensive lineman. He took starts at guard, tackle, and then jumbo, which should excite Mike Solari and Pete Carroll and the Seahawks coaching staff for sure, because that just sounds like a Seahawks offensive lineman who could play most of the spots on the line and also add that kind of George Fant extra tackle. He's a large man, 6'7", 316, and actually when you look at his picture, like on Pro Football Focus, and when we look at his picture without his body, he looks like a receiver. He looks like he's, you know, 6'3", 220, but no, he's huge. He's a big guy. And he has had some injuries, Corbin, and that, I know that's a big concern for a lot of people. He's missed 9 games the last couple of years, had a broken, I think it was tibia a couple of years or a year before that. So I understand there's some injuries concerns, but he's a two-time Pro Bowler. And for me, he just fits the bill of being a versatile offensive lineman. He's been left guard for the majority of his Saints career. And really, that's the biggest hole, I think, that the Seahawks have on the offensive line right now, maybe besides right tackle as well. But you want a guy that we've talked about this before, Corbin, where the Seahawks have had left guard after left guard after left guard. It's been a revolving door, musical chairs, insert whatever you will there. It's been a long time since the Seahawks have had a stable left guard. And Andres Pete he's only 26 years old. So you could sign him for several years. I know that the Pro Football Focus and the Pro Bowl votes are not talking to each other because one says he's great, one says he's not. But having a 26-year-old, give him a couple years on the left guard spot and see what you got. I think that the Seahawks really should look into this.
Okay, it's time for me to have my weekly venting session. I haven't gotten to do this for a while. And I, you know, sometimes I don't enjoy doing this. This one I'm going to enjoy because you just mentioned that there's a major discrepancy between Pro Bowl and Pro Football Focus. And I have been an outspoken critic of Pro Football Focus's grades for offensive linemen. And it's not just because I feel like they severely underrate Seattle offensive linemen on a consistent basis. Not that these guys are superstars, because they're not, but DJ Fluker, Jermaine Ifedi, I thought had a much better year than what his PFF score was. And I see it with other teams. There are players that I watch that I'm like, why is this guy got a 90? I don't think he's worthy of that. Oh, he gave up 6 sacks this year, and then this guy that gave up 2 gets a 43.8. Like, there's just things that don't add up. And Andrews Pete is one of the most extreme examples that I've seen. And if you were basing it off Pro Football Focus scores, he should have been a Pro Bowler his first 3 seasons when he was in the 60, upper 60s and low to mid 70s for grade. The last 2 years when he's actually made the Pro Bowl, he got 43, and I think the other one was 46 or 47. Both of his grades were near the bottom of all qualified offensive linemen, not just guards. And he made the Pro Bowl both those seasons. And basing off discussions that I've had with a few people and looking at some other data, he's given up a couple sacks each of the past few years. It's not like he's been among the top 10 and given up sacks. He's not a guy that draws a lot of penalties either. So I'm perplexed by the fact he has that low of a score. And coming from Stanford's program, you know that he's a well-trained lineman that should be able to run block to go with that. So I actually think he makes a lot of sense. If teams are basing their evaluation on what Pro Football Focus gives him, then teams might not be, they might be hesitant to give money, especially with the injuries that he had. But at the same time, like you said, he's young. He's been to the Pro Bowl the last 2 years. And the tape that I've watched, the games I've watched, I've always thought he was a pretty darn good lineman. So again, it leaves me to question, and I've had so many times that I've done this, and I don't pay for the subscription for Pro Football Focus Elite, so I don't see all their breakdowns as far as how they come up with those grades, but it just perplexes me how there are so many gaps like that. This might be the most extreme that I've seen, though, a guy getting to back-to-back Pro Bowls, and he's got some good scores from other outlets, and then Pro Football Focus says, "You're awful." Like, it makes no sense to me. Let's go to the defensive side of the football. Pass rushers, Seattle needs them in bunches. And one of the guys out there that could command pretty good bucks that's going to be available on the market, Seahawks know him well from his time with the Rams, that's Dante Fowler Jr.
Yeah, former Gator, third overall pick in 2015, came into to Jacksonville Jaguars with a lot of promise. And really, he only had one great season with the Jaguars in 2017 when they somehow got to the AFC Championship game and really was a couple plays away from getting to the Super Bowl. He made some key plays in the postseason for the Jaguars that year and had 8 sacks. And then things kind of – he had some trouble in Florida, in University of Florida. Then he kind of soured his wore out his welcome in Jacksonville and was eventually signed with the Rams. And all of a sudden last year, he had a resurgence with the Rams. I mean, model citizen, and he had 11.5 sacks last year, 58 tackles, 11.5 sacks, 16 tackles for loss, and 16 quarterback hits, all of which were career highs by a large number. And by any metric you look at, it was a career year for Dante Fowler Jr. So you know that he's going to be commanding some money. He actually was making $12 million last year anyway, so he's maybe going to try to look north of that. But as far as production, I mean, you can't argue with 11.5 sacks. Now, there is a caveat to that as far as fitting in Seattle. It seemed like he really took off, Corbin, when the Rams went to a 3-4, and he was kind of more playing as a true outside linebacker than a 4-3 defensive end and with his hand in the dirt. So schematically, I'm not sure that he's a great fit. But as far as production, I mean, he's shown that he is versatile. He had an 8-sack season with the Jaguars as a defensive end. So he does have production either way. He kind of seems like he hits and misses with production and effort. So there's always that. But he also strikes me as a guy, Corbin, who he might have issues in other places, but sometimes guys come to Seattle and just are fine. They just figure it out. Pete Carroll's a great players coach for that kind of player, the Josh Gordons of the world. I think a guy like Dante Fowler Jr. could come into Seattle, keep his nose clean, and really enjoy playing for a coach like Pete Carroll.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to give him more than $13 or $14 million a year, and I'm sure the market's going to dictate that he gets a little more than that because he had such a great year last year. And I think the main reason that I would be hesitant is because you mentioned the inconsistent production. He has two seasons in his career with just four sacks, and I do have some concerns about the schematic fit. Because, yes, he may have had eight sacks for Jacksonville a few years back playing the defensive end position, but in several seasons with the Jaguars, the consistency factor was never there, and he was playing a much different role with the Rams, as you mentioned. And yes, Seattle has some 3-4 aspects to its 4-3 defense, and they're flexible with players. I just don't know if he is the best fit. And now, again, if you could get him for that $13 million range and Jadeveon Clowney's not coming back, then it would make sense. And we know Seattle has typically gotten the most out of players. And I think you're right about the character aspect being okay in that locker room. He did okay with the Rams. So, you know, he's still a very young player. It would make some sense. Had a very productive season last year. At the same time, though, I'm looking at it as a guy that I'm just not sure if I'm quite ready to pony up the big bucks for him because of the inconsistency. He entered the league and then tore his ACL. He's had some injury issues in the past. I do have enough concerns that I just don't know that I'm going to be writing the paycheck that maybe you have to write to sign him just based on what he did last season. Now, let's wrap up this segment with a familiar name, and this is a guy that I have been pushing for the Seahawks to sign now for three seasons, I believe. I have been saying, bring Danny Shelton back to the Pacific Northwest. Former Washington standout, had his best season by far as a pro. And really the big difference for him was he needed to get out of Cleveland. And how many times do we hear that in a sentence for players that are with the Browns that go somewhere else? And not that he was bad for Cleveland, but New England is where he's really figured things out. 6'2", 345 pounds. This is a mammoth of a man.
Yeah, I mean, we talked last night about how the Seahawks are probably going to look into a more sleeker pass rush friendly defensive tackle. But really, Danny Shelton had his best year pass rushing last year. Three sacks, doubled his previous career high. Six quarterback hits tied a career high. And his 61 tackles was a career high as well. He had a career year by all metrics you can look at. And yeah, of course, going from Cleveland to New England is a pretty darn good bet to improve your career. But of course, yeah, UW kid, Auburn, Washington guy, local. I mean, that would be a really easy pitch for him to come back. And I think that the Seahawks certainly could use him. They are losing Jaron Reed, of course. He's certainly not the same player as Jaron Reed. Al Woods might be a better comp. But you really do need that guy next to Puna Ford. Puna Ford is a different defensive tackle than Danny Shelton is, but I think Danny Shelton can add a ton of value as a run stuffer and, heck, as a pass rusher. Three sacks last year would have been second on this defense, which is still pathetic.
Well, hoping that that's not the case in 2020, right. But you're right. Last year he would have been. That's still for him, being a guy that's reputation coming to the league was, you're not going to get a pass rush from him. He's a run stuffer. Those players have been devalued to an extent in today's NFL with teams slinging the rock all over the place. But I think he's always been an underrated pass rusher for his size. He's a guy that can wreak havoc. He can push the pocket back. Might not get you a ton of sacks, but he can be disruptive, and that's something they certainly could use from the interior. And I'm looking at it this way. The Seahawks have traditionally, for that nose tackle role, Puna Ford's played it, and he's an undrafted rookie, undrafted free agent, so he's getting paid a very low salary, and so he's affordable. They bring in veterans that maybe are they're the wrong side of 30 that are still good, like Al Woods, that are effective players, and you can get them for a team-friendly contract on a 1 or 2 year deal, and they've had a lot of success doing that. That's why they haven't drafted big guys like this. We talked about this on yesterday's show. A lot of the D-tackles they've drafted are in the high 290s, low 300s, and they're a little more athletic DTs. Those are the guys they draft, and then they either sign the big guys or they bring them in as undrafted free agents like they did with Brian Monet last year. But I think you need to buck that trend and go after a younger guy. I know Danny Shelton coming off a career year, he's got a new agent. He might get paid more money than what they normally like to pay at that position, but you could give him a 3-year deal and it would make a ton of sense because he's only 26 years old. He's coming off a great season. I think he's a great scheme fit for them. So I've made this argument several years in a row. I think now it's stronger than ever coming off the year that he had. Bring him back, Danny Shelton. Get him back to his home community. Get him in a Seahawks uniform. And I promise that he is going to be one of the best additions that you could possibly make, dollar for dollar, upgrading the interior of that offensive line. Draft another guy that's a more athletic defensive tackle. You get that rookie along with Danny Shelton and Puna Ford. Maybe DeMarcus Christmas contributes some this year. Suddenly, your defensive line and the interior is looking pretty darn good. So make it happen, John Schneider. Get the big fella back to the Pacific Northwest. Coming up next in the third quarter, we're going to close out our Seahawks combine thresholds by looking at cornerback and safety. What kind of measurables and drills do the Seahawks focus on most when they are evaluating those two positions in the secondary? We'll be right back. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Welcome back. Glad to have you joining us here on the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, along with Nick Lee. Over the past several days, we've been looking from a position-to-position basis at the thresholds, what Seattle is looking for from prospects at various positions. You know, what measurables, what drills matter most at certain spots. And we have reached the end of the line here. We've talked about most of the position groups. Now it's time to look at cornerback and safety in the secondary. Now, Seattle right now looks to be fairly set at safety, but that doesn't mean they couldn't draft another guy at that position. Corner, we've talked a bunch about this. This could be a season to bring some competition in to compete against Trey Flowers and really push him. And if he doesn't respond to it, maybe that guy ends up taking his job. They're all about competition in Seattle. So I think that this is a year that could be a really strong chance. You can see Seattle use a draft pick fairly early, at least by their standards, at that position. So let's look at how they have drafted at cornerback first. Now, it's interesting. One of the players that's listed on our chart, Earl Thomas, actually was listed as a corner at the 2010 Combine, which I found very interesting. There were teams that were looking at him at potentially being a corner. Seattle obviously viewed him as a free safety in their system. But if you take him out of the equation, Nick, what really jumps out to you as far as what the Seahawks have looked for, what thresholds they've had, whether it's been with measurements or drill work, to make selections of this position?
Well, what's been most documented with the cornerback, Seahawks have been very particular about the cornerbacks they draft. They like the longer guys, the 32.5 inch arms, at least on the outside corners. Now, with the slot guys, they could go a little shorter, but they have really had a specific formula to draft outside corners. I mean, just look at Trey Flowers. I swear he's a daddy long legs, or his arms are as long as his legs. I mean, he's just really long kid. And so they know that they love those longer armed corners. The vertical jump will be important, of course, for corners for 50-50 balls against taller receivers. So you're always going to be looking at that. But for the corners, it'll just depend on what they're looking for as far as outside versus slot. I would not be surprised if they take a corner in this draft that they intend on being a slot corner. I know that they like Ugo Amadi. I do too. But that doesn't mean that they can draft some competition there or some depth. But certainly, Corbin, I think the biggest thing is the measurements with the 32.5-inch arms. That is just something that they've really honed in on a lot. But as far as the drills for corners, again, like I said, the vertical and the broad jump, they really like the guys that test well the broad jump. So you have, like, Richard Sherman had a 125, or Shaquille Griffin had a 132.
Yeah, he had a phenomenal combine, and that was one of the drills. It was just kind of like, whoa.
Yeah. And then, of course, I think the thing that sticks out the most is they really like guys that can have sub-7, really, really good in the 6 seconds, a three-cone drill. I think that seems to be a really good measuring stick for a Seahawks corner, is that three-cone drill.
Yeah, if I had to rank things, I think the number one thing the Seahawks look for at the corner position, obviously they have a body type they want. They, on the outside, they want corners that are 6 foot or taller. Five of the seven corners that they have drafted, actually it's six because Earl Thomas isn't a corner, but Trey Flowers was. they've drafted a bunch of dudes that are 6 foot or taller. They've drafted three different corners that were 6'2 or taller. You had Thurald Simon, obviously didn't work things out for him in Seattle, but Thurald Simon, Richard Sherman obviously came in at 6'3", and then Trey Flowers a couple years ago at 6'3". He was listed as a safety, but the Seahawks immediately said he's playing corner. So they like those tall, lengthy guys you mentioned, 32.5-inch arms. Under that, you're not going to be drafted by Seattle if you're going to be an outside corner. The slot guys, they'll go a little bit smaller there, but I think that the measurables are extremely important from a drill standpoint. I think that it goes three cone and then vertical. It, like you said, the three cone seems to be extremely important at this position. All, now, a couple of the guys they've drafted didn't even run the three cone at the combine. I'm sure they had pro day scores, but Shaquille Griffin had a fast 6.87. Ty Smith, 6.97. Ty Smith had a 3.96 second shuttle run. So they also like the guys that can move really well in that drill as well. But I think the three cone is certainly something they look at closely at this position. They look at the explosiveness from the vertical, and they look at the body type. Slot's a little different than the outside, but they have a certain body type, arm length that they're looking for, and some athletic metrics. Now, the safety position, there are some similarities. They've drafted more safeties than they have corners over the years, just a few more safeties than corners. But again, it's pretty evident that the Seahawks are, they're looking for size at this position.
Yeah, they really are. Of course, when you think of Seahawks safeties, boom, it jumps out to you, Cam Chancellor. Cam Chancellor was 6'3", 231, coming out of Virginia Tech. That is a tank. And of course, he lived up to the billing as one of the most feared safeties, I think, and certainly of this generation. And so with safeties, they're around 200 pounds, I think, is the low end of things. Tedrick Thompson was 204, Delano Hill 216, Winston Guy was 218, Mark Legree was 210. I think the only exception was last year, actually, 195, and Marquise Blair. But of course, with 195, you have a couple Burger Kings and a protein shake, and you're at 200, so it's pretty close. So with safeties, 200 pounds, and they like taller safeties as well. Like I said, Cam Chancellor, 6'3". Trey Flowers, 6'3", was a safety, but now he's a corner. But, of course, we know that they like length. Marquise Blair, 6'1". Leno Hill, 6'1". The only one was Mark Legree at 5'11", under 6 feet. So corners as well. Broad jump is another one that's vertical jump for safeties is one that you're going to be looking at too, because you got guys in the mid-30s. Marquise Blair was a 35. Tedrick Thompson at 32.4, Trey Flowers again a corner but 34.5. So they like the corner or the safeties with the verticals, of course, because you're going to be going downfield against tall receivers. You got to win those 50-50 balls, and so they like the explosive tall and ball hawking safeties.
Yeah, it seems like at the safety position, there's not quite as much emphasis on the three-cone time, and that makes some sense. The type of stuff that safeties do compared to corners who are doing a lot of really quick change of direction when they're pressed up against receivers and stuff, it makes sense that three-cone times maybe are emphasized a little bit more. And then players like Cam Chancellor, they're going to play in the box more. It's less of a concern if that three-cone isn't quite as fast. His 7.36, not great at that particular drill, but he had a 32-inch vertical, 22 bench press reps, and a respectable 116-inch broad jump. And there's a very consistent link at the broad jump position between 116 and 125 for every single safety that they have drafted, with one exception being that Earl Thomas actually only jumped 113. That's shocking. Of all the safeties they've drafted, he was the worst at the broad jump. But there were several other drills that he was really good at. He didn't do all the drills either at the combine in Indy in 2010. But it's clearly evident that they like height in the secondary in general. Arm length matters. They're looking for players that have some explosiveness in the jumping drills. And the three cones seem to be very important to the corner position, not quite as much when they're drafting safeties. Now, let's talk some players to watch here. I think you and I can be in agreement here. I would be stunned if the Seattle Seahawks draft a corner or a safety in the first round, especially a safety given the depth that they now have.
Definitely. I mean, you have Quandre Diggs and Bradley McDougald, and I'm of the opinion that that's one of the more solid safety tandems in the NFL. So I don't think that there's an immediate need for the first round for safety, but corner, that we know they love corners, and they could certainly take some guys. And so we'll discuss a round one possibility, and then a day two possibility for both these positions. But looking for me, Corbin, for a round of first round corner, Christian Fulton, I think, is a guy that we need to look at from LSU. Of course, LSU is getting a lot of pub these days as one of the best college football teams I've ever seen last year on defense and offense. And he played man, he pressed man coverage. He's patience and balance. He's good at reading routes, and he's very highly competitive. They had a very highly competitive program at LSU this year, especially in the secondary.
And that's all about Ed Orgeron. It comes from the head man down, that competitive spirit. Former assistant for Pete Carroll, it makes a lot of sense.
It does make a lot of sense. And LSU defensive backs historically have done very well for themselves in the NFL. He seems to doesn't get fooled very often. I really like how steady he is. He does need some work as far as tackling goes. You know, the Seahawks like the corners that can stick their nose and tackle, like a Richard Sherman, who never had an issue with that. And he's missed a bit of 2017 on a suspension, but I think Ed Orgeron coming in made a huge difference for that program for him, especially. So Christian Fulton would be a guy, if, you know, gun to my head, have to pick a corner in the first round, that'd be a guy that I'd certainly look at.
Yeah, the Seahawks have not drafted a corner before the third round under Pete Carroll and John Schneider, and maybe you can look at that saying, there's always a time for a first. You know, maybe this will be the year they do it. One corner they have met with, Trayvon Diggs out of Alabama, the younger brother of Stephon Diggs, the receiver for the Minnesota Vikings. Interestingly, didn't play a lot his first couple of years at Alabama, but they're loaded, always have tons of NFL talent on their roster. So some guys don't get to play as early as others, but you can see some improving ball production. I think what the Seahawks would love about this kid, 6'2", 210. So he fits the size metrics that they're looking for at the corner spot, can play some press coverage. He's a physical run defender. He'll come up and stick people. So he fits a lot of the criteria that they are looking at. I think the one thing on film that jumped out to me watching Alabama games, he will take his gambles and he will get burned on some of them. So he's going to need to be coached up a little bit in that regard. But you can see the physical tools and you can see the size. He checks off a lot of the boxes Seattle's looking for. That being said, I think he's going to be a first-round guy, and I'd be really surprised if they picked a corner in the first round. Now, safety, just throwing names out there again, I'd be especially stunned if the Seahawks picked a safety early, especially with Marquise Blair being picked in the second round last year, and he's right behind Bradley McDougal. I think they love the depth they have with those three guys at the top at safety. But I am going to throw this name out there, Antoine Winfield Jr. If that sounds familiar, his dad played very briefly for the Seahawks at the end of his career, but he was a very good player for the Minnesota Vikings and Buffalo Bills. His dad was a corner. His son, Antoine Winfield Jr., is going to be a free safety in the NFL. He's had some injuries, but man, is he a ball hawk. And you can see some of, I'm not going to say he's Earl Thomas, but you can see some of the same stuff in his game. And he had 7 interceptions last year, finally healthy, 2 injury rigged seasons the 2 years before that. Came out and ended up having a fantastic 2019 season with 7 picks. So if they were going to pick a safety, I'm 99.9999% sure they're not going to. But if they would, that's the one player I could be like, okay, I can maybe understand it because of the ball skills and scheme fit in Seattle.
Yeah, for me, for a first-round safety, I would look at Ashton Davis from California, Cal Bears, 6'1". He's actually pretty darn close to the size of Marquise Blair, 6'1", 195. I know it's under the 200 threshold, but pretty long guy still. And he can play the one high safety, the center field. He's great range, kind of an Earl Thomas-y kind of quarterback or safety as well, where he's just a great center fielder, great hitter, pretty productive 4-year starter at safety. He had 6 interceptions the last 2 years combined. Almost 70 tackles in the last 2 years combined, over 100 tackles in his career at Cal, nearly a 4-year starter. And you know I love those 4-year starter guys, 3.5-year starters. So Ashton Davis would be a guy I looked at in the first round for safeties.
Yeah, I don't see either one of those guys getting picked by the Seahawks. But if they did, I guess I could understand it. And we know the Seahawks, and you mentioned this earlier in the show, they don't care what we think. They're going to do what they want to do. So based on the comments John Schneider made the other day, they're going to be looking to improve that secondary. And maybe they do see a safety. They're like, we need to have that kid. It would make a lot of sense. If they were going to pick at the corner or safety positions, though, I think it would be much more likely that it happens on day two. They have 2 second-round picks, and then they have a comp pick at the end of the third round, which they actually got for losing Earl Thomas in free agency last year. There are several players that maybe could make sense on day two. Let's start at the corner position. For me personally, I would go with Bryce Hall out of Virginia. This guy, 6'1", 200 pounds, so he fits a lot of the metrics from a size standpoint. 21 pass deflections in 2018. So this guy knows how to get his hands on the football. He had 5 interceptions over the past few years, so hasn't turned those into a ton of interceptions at this point, but you watch the film, you can see the range and the ball skills that this kid has. He's a solid tackler. He did have an injury that limited him to 6 games last season, but with that size, he's athletic. This is a guy I think is going to test well. I don't know how many tests he's going to actually do. I wasn't there to talk to the corners today, but he's coming off an injury. I'm wondering how many of those he's going to run, but certainly a guy that could put up good numbers in those combine drills, and I think he's a strong second-round pick coming out of Virginia.
The guy I'm going to go with in the day two area for corners is Cameron Dantzler out of Mississippi State. He's a good athlete, great length at 6'2", 185. I think that's like salivating range for Pete Carroll and his corners. That pretty darn long kid. He traveled with receivers in the SEC, which is not easy to do. And he's quick hips, a ball hawk in some senses. The interceptions weren't there, but he had 17 pass deflections in the last couple of years, 4 interceptions, a couple sacks too. He could stick his nose in there and make some tackles for loss, which I think are pretty valuable. He's actually for his length, he seemed to leave some interceptions on the field and didn't get off of very good blocks as far as run blocks and the stock blocking of the receivers really affected him. But I think as a day two project guy, maybe not an instant starter, but someone certainly that could definitely push Trey Flowers for that job eventually, is Cameron Dantzler, Mississippi State.
Going to the safety position, now I'm going to throw this name out there just because we talked about Cam Chancellor earlier. You just don't see very many safeties that come in that are athletic, that have the kind of size that Cam Chancellor did. Now, this player is coming from Southern Illinois, so it's an FCS school. It's going to be a huge jump in competition going to the NFL, but I'm expecting good testing numbers from this player. And Jeremy Chin out of Southern Illinois is 6'3", 219 pounds. So this is a guy, I know the Seahawks have talked about wanting to play Marquise Blair at free safety. I can see down the road, even with the trade they made for Diggs, I can see down the road Seattle eventually putting him back there. Who knows what they're going to do? I mean, as well as Diggs played last season, maybe he's a guy that's back there for several years for them, and it wouldn't surprise me, but you're always thinking a couple years ahead. Jeremy Chin is your future strong safety that you can put in that Cam Chancellor role at 6'3", 219. If he ends up being around 225 and can smack people, you can play him like an extra linebacker. He's got some versatility to be able to drop back in coverage a bit, cover tight ends. I'm really interested to see how he ends up testing. I've got to watch more film on him, but he's certainly a player that's draft stock seems to be shooting up by week. He's really been talked about a lot. It was a name I heard several times at the combine. People were talking about him. So I can see him being a player that sneaks into the second round. Maybe if Seattle is lucky, because he's a small school player, he's still available at the end of the third round with a comp pick. I think that pick would actually make a lot of sense, because that is the kind of safety they like to have at that strong safety spot, and they haven't had that element really since Cam Chancellor was forced to retire.
And for my day two safety, I'm actually going to stick with the Mississippi State Bulldogs, oddly enough. Brian Cole, safety. He fits more of the bill as far as measurables go than the guy I mentioned earlier. 6'2", 210, and he's a team captain in 2019, Senior Bowl participant. And he actually played at Eastern Mississippi Community College last chance U fans. 2 sacks and interception last year, pretty productive as far as just being around the field and just being a nuisance to offenses. 38 solo tackles, 67 total tackles, and there is a bit of concern, of course, with only playing 1 year of Division I college football. He only played 1 year at Mississippi State, but versatile. He shows willingness to tackle in the run game, which you know the Seahawks are going to love in a safety. He's got high IQ in the pass game, recognizes routes and recognizes the quarterback's eyes. And he also can suit up and play a little money linebacker. So he's been all over the field, and he can kind of be your jack of all trades safety, which is increasingly more valuable these days on defenses.
Yeah, we've talked about how a lot of these defenses, it's, at certain positions at least, it's no longer really a position. You have guys that can do a number of different things that are really Swiss Army knives, and those players are increasing in value by year in the NFL, and you're going to see more of those players go early. We talked about Zach Bond yesterday at defensive end and being a hybrid linebacker that can play inside and out. Those kind of players, the value just keeps skyrocketing because they can do so much, and it gives you flexibility, especially against no-huddle offenses, teams that run RPOs, you name it. Having a guy that can do multiple things like that is extremely important, and it really can be a benefit to an NFL team. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at CorbinSmithNFL. You can follow Nick at NickLee51. Make sure to subscribe to our show on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast platform is, by visiting us online at LockedOnSeahawks.com. Coming up on Monday, Rob Rang and I will recap some of the biggest offensive winners from the Combine from a Seahawks perspective, plus our Monday mailbag. You won't want to miss it. Enjoy your weekend. Go Hawks!